Okay. Well, hi, everybody. Thanks for showing up. So let me first maybe explain a little bit what the motivation of this discussion session is about. So there's been recently a couple of papers, I guess more maybe coming, for which the main lead authors are Oskar Åkerlund, who is here, and Philippe de Forcan, who is here. And a couple of these papers also involve myself and Philippe Werner from the University of Fribourg in Switzerland. And these papers actually have applied some ideas that are, I would say, derived from an established theoretical technique in condensed matter theory, which is called dynamical mean field theory, applying some of these ideas to lattice gauge, to lattice field theories. Okay, so I'm not going to review the content of these papers that Philippe and Oskar will do and explain the results, but my goal is much more limited than that. What I want to do is, in about 20 minutes on the board, give you a brief introduction to what the hell dynamical mean field theory is, seen from the perspective of a condensed matter theorist, but hopefully in a language that we can share and you guys can relate to. Okay, so that's, if you want, DMFT, a primer. And this is a field which has a long history. The method was introduced more than 20 years ago. So it's not going to be a review of the whole field. That's impossible to do in just a brief amount of time. And it's also not going to be a review of what would be current applications of this technique in condensed matter physics. Okay, it's just really just a primer about the method. Okay, so first I have to tell you what kinds of problems we are interested in as theorists in condensed matter physics, especially dealing with materials that have so-called strong electronic correlations, which means that electrons have strong interactions between themselves, but most importantly, they actually live in atomic shells which have fairly narrow, fairly small kinetic energy. So this means in these systems, the electrons live in shells which are sufficiently localized around the atoms that the electrons spend a long time sitting on the atom before, from time to time, delocalizing from one atom to the others. And so in such a situation, we really have to do a good job about the local atomic physics of the problem. So just to fix idea, let me introduce some sort of iconic model that is not a very materials realistic model, but is a very, very simple model that embodies the main ingredients of electronic correlations. And that's the infamous Hubbard model, which, if you want, in this field plays a little bit same conceptual role than the Ising model would play in magnetism. It's not a very realistic model, but it's an extremely important model because it's very simple to formulate.
So if you had to quantify how many people, or what fraction of people working on supercomputing think it's a good model or not?
Okay, so you are talking about cuprate superconductors?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, let me give you my personal opinion, okay? I think for cuprate superconductors, this is a very good model. Okay. I don't want to speak for anybody. So what?
We can vote. I'm for it.
Okay, good. Wonderful. So condensed matter physicists, please vote. Anyhow, but of course, real materials, besides cuprates, you know, there's a whole zoo of correlated materials, and they involve a lot more degrees of freedom than just the simple Hubbard model I'm going to write on the board. But I don't want to enter in any of that. I just want to give the concept. Okay, so what is the Hubbard model? Well, one way to view it is the following. Let's take some lattice, and you all like lattices here, like this 2D lattice. We put some fermions on this lattice. These are non-relativistic fermions, I'm sorry, okay? And let me create an electron on one side with some creation operator that acts on site I, and we have spin-half fermions. So we have quantization axis along Z up or down fermions. Okay, and so the Hamiltonian of this model has two terms. There is one term which is just hopping the fermions around on the lattice. So in just simple second quantized notation, that would be something like this. So that hops an electron from site I to site J with a certain amplitude Tij. And that would be free fermions, of course. We may want to add some chemical potential to control the overall density of fermions, which is an important parameter in the problem. And we add to this thing an interaction, and we're going to choose the simplest possible interaction, completely local in space. And the only term I can write in that case is just, let's say, repulsion. I'm going to mostly focus on repulsion between two fermions living on the same site with, of course, opposite spins, because I cannot put two fermions with the same spin on the same site. Okay? So that's the Hubbard model. And the sort of conventional way of thinking about this model is to say these are free fermions on the lattice, however, which are subject to an interaction. And if you open any textbook in solid-state physics, the first thing that you would like to do, usually, is to diagonalize the free fermion part, and then think of the interaction as something you're going to treat afterwards. So let me do that. Let's look at U equal to zero. We can, of course, diagonalize this problem. We just go to reciprocal space. We have some quasi-momentum in the, let's say, Brillouin zone of the lattice, okay? And we can immediately diagonalize this. This is going to be sum over k. So this term is going to be sum over k sigma of some dispersion times c dagger k sigma c k sigma, right? And epsilon k is just essentially the Fourier transform of my hoppings. I'm not careful about factors here, okay? So the dispersion, the way epsilon k depends on k, is what kind of matter people call a band. So in 1D, for example, with nearest neighbor hopping, we would have some band like that. And that would be edge of the Brillouin zone minus pi over a, pi over a. And since we have a finite density of fermions, we have a Fermi level, which is somewhere, which is in direct relation to mu, which controls the number of fermions per site. Okay. And so the second step, which is usually taken, is to try to do something with interactions. And of course, you can develop, for example, a whole bunch of perturbative methods to treat this problem in real space. This is just a local vertex. In momentum space, you may want to draw it like this, with conservation of momenta. But anyhow, we can use the techniques of perturbative many-body theory to try to handle this problem from the weak coupling side. Okay, so that's really the standard solid-state physics kind of picture, where you view electrons as forming an electron gas, and then you try to understand the effect of interactions on top of that. Yes?
Is there a real space?
Yes, so the real space wave function of the free case is a Slater determinants of orbitals, right, that are built out of the single particle states. The real space wave function of the real problem is, of course, unknown. Okay, so before I go any further, I should say, okay, what about numerical methods to deal with this problem? And, of course, these numerical methods have been the subject of a lot of work, but if we are talking about Monte Carlo methods, whatever flavor, quantum Monte Carlo methods for this sort of problem are plagued with the well-known minus sign fermion problem, which in this context appears in the repulsive model and when the density is different on average than one particle per site. If there is one particle per site, you can actually show by some transformations, at least for simple cases, that you can get rid of the minus sign problem. But generically there is, and of course that limits considerably what can be done by direct Monte Carlo studies of these problems. Okay, so in order to give you an idea of what DMFT is, I want you to think of this model in a completely different, with a very different perspective. I want you to think of this not as an electron gas with some interactions on top of that, but as a collection of small many-body problems, fully interacting, which are my atoms. After all, solids are not electron gases. Solids are a bunch of atoms bound together. And we're going to think of this problem as a bunch of atoms, right? And so instead of looking first at this, I want you first to look at this, okay? So this is decoupled Hamiltonians from side to side, so I can think of just an isolated atom, which would have a simple Hamiltonian, which is this. Let me use density operators now, because n is just c dot c. Okay, so this is just one atom on one side. It's also a very simple problem, but it's not a quadratic fermion problem. However, it's a sufficiently simple problem that I can diagonalize it for you. It has four states, and it's diagonal already in the number representation. It has four states. One is zero, has energy zero. One is actually doubly degenerate, up or down, has energy minus mu. And another one is the doubly occupied state, which has energy u minus 2 mu. Right. So it's really the simplest sort of Mickey Mouse picture of an atom. We just have one level which can be filled by 0, 1, or 2 electrons. And when these when there are two electrons, we pay a cost u. Okay. And so what I'm going to, the way I'm going to think about this model is now to think, to focus on one atomic site and think of the histories in time of the quantum fluctuations between these different atomic states as the, say, imaginary time goes on. So here I have to make clear that I'm dealing with a model in D spatial dimensions, so this would be D equal 2. And of course, we have to quantize this model. We have to introduce an additional direction, which, so that would be D plus 1. And in most of the talk, this one will be an imaginary time. So we work in Euclidean space, if you want, in which tau, if we are at finite temperature, would be confined between 0 and beta, where beta is 1 over kT.
The
yes.
There is
C dagger C. And it's just, yeah, that's right. Sorry. I'm a bit sloppy here. This is sum over sigma of n sigma. And n sigma is C dagger sigma C sigma. Okay. I've just rewritten that.
And the
okay.
Temperature potential
is the same. Yeah, so I've taken one chemical potential. I'm in a translationally invariant system, let's say. Okay, I'm just preparing the problem to deal with the whole lattice. And in that context, the chemical potential of its opposite is really just the nominal position of the atomic level. Good. So I'm interested in the histories of configurations of this system as a function of tau. And of course, the simplest way to formulate this is to introduce some half integral representation. So I'm now going to quantize this Hamiltonian. So I guess I can erase the Hamiltonian. You've all seen it. I'm going to quantize this Hamiltonian by going to an action formalism. So let me write the action. So each trajectory will be weighted by e to the minus s. And s will be integral from 0 to beta d tau of the Hamiltonian of my Hubbard model, so the whole lattice Hamiltonian, that's what I mean, okay, plus the usual PQ dot, if you want, quantization theorem, which is going to be integral from 0 to beta d tau, sum over I and sigma of C dagger I sigma d d tau C I sigma, and these guys are now Grassmann variables, okay? So that's the usual way of quantizing the Hamiltonian problem. Okay, so of course, this weight tells me what is the weight of a given history of these fermions as time evolves, as imaginary time evolves. And you can do the following thing. Focus on a given site, okay? And at some given time, this site is in state, let's say, zero. At some later time, it's going to be in state up. At some later time, it may be in state doubly occupied, and so on, okay? And this happens because fermions can leave this site and arrive onto this site by jumping to their neighbors, okay? So here, the fermion has come in with up spin. Here, another fermion has come in with down spin, and so on. Okay. Now, I want you to think of a different problem, which is one in which, instead of having this lattice of other sites, I would consider this world trajectory here, but in which fermions come and go to this specific site coming from an outside reservoir. Okay, so imagine I have the same problem, okay, but now a single atom, okay, which is, however, coupled to an outside reservoir, which has no special spatial structure, right? And I can take and eject electrons between my red site and the reservoir at any given imaginary time with a certain one-body amplitude for doing this that I'm going to call delta of tau minus tau prime. Okay, so this is a lattice problem. This is a single atom problem coupled to a reservoir of electrons, right? So a priori, these are very different problems. I can also write the weight of the for the trajectories of this problem. And these weights would be described by another action, which is the following. So S, let's call this atom plus bath, okay, is going to be now the Hamiltonian of my isolated atom. So that was just these two terms, the U and the minus mu, okay? There would be, of course, always this canonical quantization term. And then there would be a one-body amplitude for actually taking an electron. So that's a two-time thing by which I can create an electron on my site at time tau with a certain amplitude delta and remove it at a certain later or earlier time tau prime. Okay. So on the left, we have the quantization of a lattice problem, which I want you to think of as a collection of atoms exchanging electrons. And on the right, we have one atom which borrows and gives electrons to an outside reservoir. And so what dynamical mean field theory aims at doing is actually choosing this problem, looking at this problem, and finding a way to determine this amplitude in such a way that this problem does the best possible job at reproducing the local physics of this problem. So that's the general concept. Okay, so how do we do that? The way we do that is by deciding which quantity we are going to try to reproduce best from the original lattice problem. And this quantity will actually be the single, what we call in Kanner's matter theory, the single particle Green's function, what you guys, I suppose, call the two-point function, right, of a field theory. So the one particle Green's function, or two-point function, is going to be in the lattice problem, some time order guy in which I create an electron on site I with given spin at a given time and destroy it at some other time. Okay, and all this is weighted with e to the minus s. While in this local problem, I can only look at the local guy, and it's going to be just exactly the same thing. Now I don't need a site index, okay? So that would be the local thing.
Antoine, can you raise the screen?
I don't know how to do that, but oh yeah, just manually. Great. You know, pre-electronics ages. That's fantastic. Okay, so how am I going to connect these two things? I'm going, of course, to request that this local object in this single atom plus bar theory coincides with the local guy of my lattice problem. So that would be one first request, that g of tau, gii of tau minus tau prime, if you want, of the lattice coincides with the g of this atom problem plus bath. Let me call it g, I don't know. We call it impurity, but that's not so great. So let me call it local of tau minus tau. So that will be a request. I want this to be a good, to do a good job on reproducing this this local G. But of course, I need something else, right? Because imagine somebody, some clever numerical person, perhaps God, gives me this for the three-dimensional Hubbard model. Okay, I can presumably always find an appropriate delta, right? Which, because it's a one-to-one problem, I'm not sure about invertibility, but assuming invertibility, I can find one delta by which, when solving this local problem, I will be able to reproduce that guy. Okay? So it's a little bit like saying, if I backtrack a little bit and give you some general view on mean field theories, imagine we just do the Ising model. So in the Ising model, we do something extremely similar, right? We think of the lattice problem, we don't know how to solve it. We pick an observable. In that case, it's the local magnetization, usually, even though we can extend that, as you will see, the local magnetization, and we aim at reproducing the best we can this local magnetization from a local problem, which in the case of the Ising model is just one spin in an external field, the so-called Weiss field, right? So in the Ising model, if you want, what we have is an observable, which is the local magnetization. We have a local problem, which is just one spin in an external field, in the Weiss field, right? And we request this sort of relation. So this will be just saying that M, of course, which is in that case tanh beta, H effective, right, is actually the same as the lattice one, but then we need a self-consistency condition that tells us how to pick the Weiss field from the original lattice problem. Let's call this the self-consistency condition, which in the case of Ising mean field theory will be that H effective is the mean field, the mean local field. Okay, so something like that. And this gives a set of two closed equations, which are the mean field equations. Please note that when we do such a thing, right, we've picked the observable to be the order parameter of the phase transition we are interested in the case of the Ising model. But we don't need to do that. We may be interested in doing a good job on the high temperature disordered phase, for example, in which case the order parameter is zero, and if we just do that, we do nothing, right? Here, I've picked an observable, which is not an order parameter of anything, right? It's there both in an order phase or in a disordered phase, and I'm interested in understanding this, the structure of this observable, even though it's not the order parameter of any phase transition. So mean field concept is much more general than just picking the order parameter and writing a Landau theory of something. Okay, so the analogy of this to that is that here our observable is G. Instead of being just a scalar like M, it's a full function of energy or time. And the conjugate effective field, like the Weiss field, is also promoted to be a full function of energy or time. It is this delta, right, which is not a scalar, but a full function. OK, so now what I want to tell you is what is the last building block, is what is the analogous to this self-consistency equation to have a closed set of equations. So to do that, we are going to take a big leap. Up to now, everything could perhaps be viewed as exact, because I could say, given the exact G, I could find a delta, right? Now I'm going to make an approximation. And to do that, I'm going to consider the Dyson equation for these two theories. So on the left-hand side, for the lattice problem, I can go to momentum space, for example, just for simplicity, I don't need to. I'm considering, let's say, a completely translationally invariant phase with no symmetry breaking, just to make my life easy at the beginning. I'm writing the Fourier transform of this single particle Green's function. And from this, I can define the self-energy, which will be free particle propagator of this theory, which is I omega n coming from the derivative term, plus chemical potential coming from the mu term, and minus all the many-body effect that I encapsulate to a Dyson self-energy. And this object is kn omega dependent. Okay. Sorry, the n here stands for Matsubara frequency if we work at finite temperature, otherwise call it I omega. So now I can do the same job here, right? I can write G local of I omega n as being what? Well, we still have this I omega n from this guy, okay? We still have the mu from this guy. And now we have the one body part, which is delta. So that gives me delta of I omega n. And we have some local self-energy, which is actually only frequency dependent. Right? And I, of course, omitted minus one here. Yes, and I also omitted, thank you very much, George. There is a minus epsilon k here that I should have really put there. So this is I omega n plus mu minus epsilon k minus sigma. Thank you. Okay, so now comes the approximation. I'm going to make the following statement, that the k dependence of the self-energy here can be completely neglected. So I'm going to make an approximation by which the self-energy of my local, of my lattice problem, is k-independent, which means completely site-local. Okay. So when is that good? Is this a crazy approximation or not? Well, if I am at very high temperature, all the correlation length, the spatial correlation length, are small, right? So it's likely to be a very good approximation at very high temperature. If I'm in the limit, in the very strong coupling limit, where the hopping between atoms is small, the Tijs, imagine they are zero, this is also a very good approximation, because by construction, sigma is local. Right? There is no non-local effect. If I am at zero coupling, U equals zero, this is also a very good approximation, because sigma is zero, and there is nothing more k-independent than zero everywhere, right? So this is an approximation which we expect on physical grounds to be good at small, very small u, very close to the very strong coupling limit of isolated atoms, and probably also very high temperature or very high energy. Okay, so let's just buy that for a minute and do this approximation. Then immediately you see, there was a question.
So probably I missed one. So you have an ordinal theory here.
Yes.
Why do you add a dirty term there? It simplifies it?
No, if I didn't have a delta term, right, that would be just quantizing one isolated atom in a way which is way too sophisticated to actually deal with this problem, because it's just a 4x4 diagonal matrix, right?
Okay.
The reason I've added a delta term is that in the real problem, electrons don't stay put on their atoms.
Okay.
They come and go. In reality, they come to the next atom. And this delta is there to say, when they come to the next atom, I will consider that this guy has gone to a reservoir. So that's what the delta does.
So in that sense, the term with the equation whisper, that term is a more realistic model than the one on the left?
Well, this term is, this thing is still a local model, which, however, has the capacity of having the local state on my atomic site to fluctuate between the different four quantum states. Okay? I can give you maybe a different perspective on this. Let's imagine we start from the lattice action, right? And we integrate out all the sites except for my red site. So we do a partial functional integral over all the other ones, right? Then I will, of course, generate all sorts of higher order cumulants in that local effective action. And this is the truncation to the one body term of this effective action. Okay? That's another perspective on the problem.
So near a phase transition that depends on k becomes very large.
Of course. So near a phase transition for describing the behavior of the one particle correlation function, okay, this approximation will break down at some point. Obviously.
And in which regime you want to use it?
Can I first write the equation before we discuss the consequences? Okay, so let me now write the equation. Okay, so you see that the only thing I have to do is to request this, and I can write this in momentum space if you want. This will mean that the local theory is the k-integrated Green's function of the interacting theory. So that's I omega n plus mu minus epsilon k, thanks to George. And now I'm going to use for sigma this approximation, this equation here, which is the equation that gives sigma for the local model. So sigma is now going to be minus I omega n plus mu minus delta minus g minus 1 local. Okay, so now let me simplify this equation, and I get g local of I omega equals sum over k. All these sums are normalized to 1 in the Boyle zone. 1 over g local minus 1 plus delta minus epsilon k. Okay. So this is the self-consistency equation that relates the local two-point function to the delta, right? And you see that obviously when, for example, there is no hopping, epsilon k is zero in the decoupled atom limit, this is just telling me that delta is zero, which it has to be because there is no communication with the path. Okay, so in a nutshell, the thing you have to do is you have to solve this problem here for a given delta. That's a problem of a one atom in a bath with an arbitrary amplitude, one body amplitude that you don't know a priori. And you have to make sure that you can calculate G local from this, if you have a good way to solve this problem, which is a complicated many-body problem. And you can plug back this G local in this equation, find a new delta, and after some iteration cycle from delta to G local between equation 1 and equation 2, this would be equation 2, this would be equation 1, right? You can find, hopefully, a pair of converged solutions which solve your equation.
There's always convergence, or is it a tricky issue?
There is always convergence, and it's not a tricky issue. And now comes the cherry on the cake. The cherry on the cake is that even though the original problem had a very bad minus sign problem away from half-filling, that's now a technical numerical statement, this sort of problem, which has been known for decades in the context of condensed matter physics for completely different reasons, which have to do with magnetic impurities in metals, this sort of problem, at least when there is only one species of electron, here there are one species with spin, let's say, like here, are free of minus sign problem in all the regimes of power meter. So there are very, very efficient quantum Monte Carlo algorithms of various flavors that really allow to do a good job on this, and hence, to solve these equations, which can also be solved with many other algorithmic techniques, like numerical normalization group, or things like that. Yes?
But the two-point function doesn't contain all the information of the system.
Exactly. That's a very good question. So how, from this, can we calculate four-point functions?
Well, so where do you put U? Where does U appear?
OK, U is here, of course. This Hamiltonian is minus mu c dagger c plus u and up and down, right? So this contains the whole local interaction.
But then where does t appear?
Here.
Epsilon, okay.
Only in the self-consistency condition, which of course will influence what delta is in the end.
I have probably a very simple misunderstanding. In the Hamiltonian form, this is a four-state problem, right?
This is a four-state problem. Correct.
So it's got four states.
Yes.
And if I stay in the Hamiltonian form, there are transition rates
yes.
between those four states.
Yes.
That gives it most, I don't know, six parameters.
No. Because in order, let's imagine.
That's my question.
Yeah.
If I view it in the Hamiltonian
yes.
form, I can't understand how I can have a continuous function to play with.
That's right. So In order to put this problem in Hamiltonian form, which is exactly what you are saying, we need infinitely many degrees of freedom in the bath.
Oh, it's because it has this memory.
Exactly.
How long ago?
Exactly.
Get off of that.
So the one way you can do that, and this is a very good question because it also allows me to explain with my hand waving why it doesn't have minus sign.
Yes.
In order to put this in Hamiltonian form,
yes.
the thing you can do. Is take my red side, imagine this is red, okay, now this is red, okay, and decouple that guy just by Gaussian integration into whatever I want to represent this omega dependence, and that could be a chain, for example. I can do that. Just, this is essentially a continuous fraction decomposition of that guy. I need infinitely many sides, of course, and this is why it's not a simple problem, but it's essentially 1 plus 1d, hence no minus.
So my memoryless state is just a very uninteresting limit,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
So if you take large u, the out feeling, then
okay.
you reproduce yes. the generic perturbation
theory. Yes, so the nice thing about this theory is that it can describe large u and small u. In large u, but I'm running out of time, you know. Yeah, that's the problem. So I honestly think these guys are. So I honestly think I should just stop there. In a nutshell, you know, the idea behind this is two things. Is to view the system as a collection of interacting many-body problems coupled by the hopping, instead of viewing it as electron gas plus interactions. That's the sort of qualitative thing. And the second idea is to generalize the usual concept of mean field, like the one from the Ising model, to an effective vice field, if you want, which has which selectively privileges the time dependence, okay? And yeah, that's essentially a concept. So it's a quantum generalization of mean field in which the payoff, the price you have to pay is to basically have to consider a local many body problem instead of, like in the Ising model, just a single scalar problem.
Well, it's not about the same problem if you have several C's, like in relativistic field theory.
Yes. Well, yeah, there are several things, not rigorously, but empirically. And that depends on this becomes a matrix. And this depends on the structure of this matrix. If this matrix is diagonal, you are fine. If it has the off-diagonal elements, you are not so fine. But yeah, probably I should take perhaps one question and then stop. Because
you should tell this community about the large dimensionality.
Yes, I should. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Thank you. Okay. So actually, apart from these different limits in which this is qualitatively reasonable perhaps, there is one limit in which this is exact. I should have mentioned that. Well, thanks for reminding me. Okay?
It's
my
work.
It's my work, yes. It's so old, that's the thing. Is that if you take the limit of the spatial dimension being infinite, these equations become exact. So for very much the same reasons that mean field theory is exact for the Ising model in large D, so that will not surprise any of you. The point is that these equations properly also generalize to phases with long-range order, which I didn't describe, allow you to essentially solve the Hubbard model in infinite dimensions. And they are really exact in this limit. Okay, I'll stop here. And I apologize to you guys. Apparently doing it in 20 minutes was kind of a challenge.
So the idea is that you get the triple feature today, and then when discussing the order of the speakers, we thought that by now you would be accustomed to a French accent, so making your job.
Should I? So I'm going to repeat several things that Antoine explained to you, but using a slightly different language because of the different community. So the project. I'm sorry. Thanks. Yeah, the project involves Antoine, Oscar, and also Philippe Werner, who's at the University of Fribourg. And actually, the project originated from a coffee discussion Philippe and I had in Zurich. And he was telling me, well, I'm using DMFT, works fantastically well for condensed matter. Why don't you consider it for quantum field theory on the lattice? And I immediately thought that this wouldn't work because of an objection that was already raised, that in quantum field theory, the situation is different from condensed matter. In condensed matter, the crystal spacing, the lattice spacing is fixed. It's a physical quantity, whereas in lattice field theory, we want to take the continuum limit, call it A, going to zero. And that means since the correlation length xi is fixed in physical units, in our case, then xi over A diverges. So the continuum limit of a lattice quantum field theory is obtained in the vicinity of a second order phase transition. You need the correlation length to diverge. So you need, if you're thinking of an approximation method, then this approximation method better be good in the regime of a second order phase transition. And obviously that cannot be the case for DMFT, because DMFT is rooted in a single side approximation, and it was already mentioned by Antoine that when the correlation length diverges, you run into trouble. So is this really hopeless by construction? And the answer is perhaps no, because as you saw, DMFT already knows about the free case. It has the exact long distance Green's function. And in the interacting case, it provides some approximate answer for the self energy so that you can plug that into the Green's function of the interacting problem, which I write here in my in the field theory notation. And if you know something about the self energy here, then you know something about the long distance Green's function, and perhaps you can control the approximation even in the regime where the correlation length is large. So we decided to test this in the simplest context, which is the case of a real field with a 5/4 interaction in D dimensions. And this is the paper. So this is just to set up the notation. All the lattice guys know all this in their dreams. So this is the continuum Euclidean Lagrangian density, kinetic term, mass term, interaction term. And then to study this model on the lattice, you make a chain of variables such that you multiply everything that's dimensionful by the appropriate power of A to get only dimensionless quantities that your computer knows how to handle. So this is the customary chain of variables. You trade your variables M0 and G0 for kappa and lambda. And then this is the discretized version of your Euclidean action on the lattice. So there's a hopping term, a quadratic term, and a quartic term. And this lattice action, just like the continuum action, has a global Z2 symmetry. You can flip the sign of phi everywhere in your system, and that preserves the action. And that's how you approach the continuum limit. This Z2 global symmetry can be spontaneously broken. When that happens, there's a phase transition, just like ferromagnetism. And this phase transition is second order. It's associated with divergent correlation length. Therefore, you can study a continuum limit of your lattice theory in that vicinity. So this is, of course, what happens. The symmetry is realized. The symmetry breaks spontaneously here or there. And you're interested in the vicinity of this massless case. So this is the rephrasing of the DMFT self-consistent treatment that Antoine was presenting before. This is our lattice action. I'm going to focus on a single site, which has a whorl line like this. And the traditional condensed matter language is to call this single site an impurity. So I'm using this subscript imp for impurity. So I view, like Antoine explained, I view this impurity as being coupled to a heat bath. That's the surrounding sites. And the heat bath induces an effective action for this single site, for which I make an ansatz of this kind. So there's an external, a linear term with an external field coming from the neighboring sites. And then there's a quadratic term with a non-local kernel, which was, here it's called delta. Here I call it K for kernel. And that's a quadratic term. And this is my quartic interaction. And then in principle, I would have other terms, phi cube, and higher powers of phi, and I neglect these higher dimension terms. The reason why I discard them is that when lambda is equal to zero, then I have just a quadratic action, and this quadratic action I know how to solve. This is translation invariant, so I can go to Fourier space, diagonalize my action, and I obtain the Green's function immediately, and it's going to be of that kind for the free case when lambda is equal to zero.
Can you work at continuous time?
No. This is my four-dimensional lattice action.
Okay.
Fine. We would.
I'm just asking. It's a question. I'm not.
Yeah. So I'm just taking the usual Euclidean lattice problem and trying to find a quick approximate solution to it. Okay. And I don't want to change the starting problem. I just want to solve it faster. And this is going to be crucially interesting when the original problem has a sign problem. Or when it has fermions which are intractable, like dynamical overlap fermions. When you have these hurdles, then approximate methods are worth exploring. Okay. So this is my truncated effective one-site action, for which this is the Green's function in the free case, and then in the interacting case, of course, I have a self-energy. And for the full problem, I can also write my free Green's function corresponding to lambda equals zero, my self-energy, and my full Green's function. Okay, this one depends.
So these five fields, they are fermions or bosons?
Bosons.
They're bosons, yeah. So it's a bosonic dynamic movement here.
For now, I'm just looking for the simplest. It is like the easing model. Actually, when lambda goes to infinity, you see that the fluctuations of phi square away from one are suppressed, so it really goes smoothly into the easing model. So really the basic.
And then was the p path, does lambda in one theory mean the same as lambda in the other theory?
I'm sorry, your accent is not one I'm familiar with.
is lambda the same in both theories?
Yes. Thank you. Okay, so these are my definitions, and now this box here describes the self-consistency iteration loop that you iterate until you get self-consistency. So it rests on these two definitions. So suppose you give yourself a starting guess for this kernel here, then you can run a little Monte Carlo on this spin chain or this 0 plus 1 dimensional problem, and this Monte Carlo will give you the Green's function as a function of t minus t prime or omega in Fourier space. And then using this equation, you can obtain the corresponding self-energy. Okay, it's here. And then, so that's step number one, which involves a one-dimensional Monte Carlo. Then you make this magic DMFT approximation, saying that this self-energy here is actually equal to the self-energy there. And in particular, you can drop the dependence on the spatial momentum k. This is clearly an approximation, but that's the root of, that's the heart of DMFT. As Antoine explained, there are good reasons to make this. So once you accept this, then you can compute the Green's function from this side back to this side in the full problem. You can do that by doing a Fourier transform. So it's a sum over all momenta. For omega fixed, you sum over spatial momenta, k. And here you have a factor, phase factor, exponential minus ikx. But x is zero, because you go from one point back to the same point. So this phase factor is one. And then each Fourier component gives you this contribution here. So once you know the self-energy, you can reconstruct the Green's function from the impurity back to the impurity given by the full problem.
So I have a question.
Yes?
Hope my accent is familiar. So in the condensed matter world, making this approximation seems very sensible to me. But if you're eventually interested in Lorentz invariance theory, is it a good idea to say that something is k independent but omega dependent?
That was basically the answer I gave to Philip Werner. This cannot work. And then he convinced me, and I had a fantastically good student, Oscar, to implement this, to check. I was convinced that this was not a good idea in quantum field theory, but I wanted to to show that indeed it was not a good idea. You're going to see the results.
Okay.
Wait a few minutes. Okay. So now you take the second step, reconstruct G, and then once you have the Green's function, you take it to be the Green's function of the impurity, the one side problem, and then you can plug it into this equation here to extract a new value for this kernel in the effective action. So once you have a new value, you plug it into there, you run your Monte Carlo, get et cetera, and you iterate these three steps until convergence. And so you get rather quickly to a fixed point, and at the fixed point, this quantity doesn't move anymore. So really, what you obtain from this equation here is equal to that equation here. The single site effective action is able to reconstruct, to give you a Green's function, which is equal to the Green's function of the full problem, modulo the approximation on the self-energy. Okay. So the question is, how well does this work? And this is a selection of results for the four-dimensional case, which are 3+1 dimensions, which is what we really are interested in. For two cases, a small quartic coupling and a large quartic coupling. And what's shown is the magnetization, the average value of the field, as a function of kappa, the ferromagnetic coupling, what we call the Hopping parameter. And so you see green is the Monte Carlo, the exact answer, the Monte Carlo of the full four-dimensional system. So it's the exact answer, and you see that there's a symmetry breaking at this critical value of kappa. Moreover, 4 is the upper critical dimension of this system, so the critical exponents are mean field. So in particular here you have a square root description of the magnetization. And that is shown in this log-log inset here. The slope of this straight line is 1/2. Okay, so green is the Monte Carlo, the exact result. This here is the traditional mean field answer, which gives you the wrong value for the critical coupling by a lot. And then DMFT are the red symbols. It's hard to distinguish between the two.
But the mean field is, to my standard, it's not very wrong. It's only the difference appear in the fourth digit.
You guys don't understand.
So in the mathematics, it means exact.
Okay. Depends how much effort you want to spend to get a better answer. This is the case of a small quartic coupling, and you can say, well, that's normal because this DMFT is arranged to give the correct free answer. So we're not that far from free field. Okay, so let's crank up the interaction. And again, green is the Monte Carlo here, red is the DMFT, and this is the ordinary mean field.
What's the L equals 75 again? Sorry.
Yeah. So the Monte Carlo was on a system which had 32 sites in each direction, and the DMFT used a chain of 75 sites. In retrospect, we don't have any good explanation why.
So this is not a single site. Is it cluster DMFT?
No.
It's a single site.
Single cell DMFT from your point of view, which really means it's having a whole chain.
It's a whirl line of a single site.
It's a whirl line.
Okay.
And single site.
Single cell in space.
0+1 dimension.
Single cell in space.
Do you know the reason why DMFT is in the opposite side of the main field in terms of frequency?
No intuition for that.
Intuitively, I expect that it's closer.
Okay. So if you compare green and red, then you see that the critical coupling here is given with two or three digits accuracy. And the critical exponents, you see here they're perfect, and here the slope of the green line is not quite the same as that of the red DMFT data. So, but the exponents still come within 10% accuracy. So yeah, that works pretty well, and we can illustrate this on more complicated problems. But I want to call your attention to what's called EMFT here, which is the blue dotted line, and which is almost as good as DMFT. So EMFT is the idea of Oscar, and it's even simpler than DMFT. It's really a single side, not a world line, but a single side approximation. And what I have against Oscar is he suggested to call it extended mean field theory, whereas the approximation is even more local than before. But anyway, it's too late to change. So what is the motivation? This figure shows the result of DMFT. Remember, DMFT gives you the self-energy as a function of omega, the frequency, the Matsubara frequency. So here is omega, and here is the difference, the deviation of the free energy, of the self-energy from its value at zero. So the point I want to make is this is extremely flat, and the higher the dimensionality of your problem, the flatter this becomes. The natural scale for this would be one. So you see it's just a few percent variation in four dimensions. This flatness motivated Oscar to suggest that we could just drop the omega dependence while we were there. Why keep this thing? It doesn't matter.
So,
if this is a case of solid state, you could just do hard reform.
Right. This is not hard reform.
Why not?
Because this, you have to compare this to the second moment of the order parameter.
Right.
So this is a generalization of mean field theory that has both the order parameter and the second moment of the distribution of the order parameter in the theory. Has nothing to do with hard reform.
You see, we still work with the Green's function.
It's like spherical model approximation in the other states. That's much more closer analogy.
So it's only one parameter.
Two parameters.
Two. Yeah, yeah, that's the crucial point.
The other parameter, and
it's written here.
Square.
Because you're in the Green's
symmetry phase. Yeah, but in the high temperature phase, half record gives you zero. While here in the broken symmetry phase, half record, this theory keeps the variance of the
fluctuation.
Okay.
So is it similar like to a Hubbard 1, Hubbard 2?
No.
Okay. So.
So what is wrong with your intuition from the beginning? What was wrong with the.
Okay, so my skepticism came from the fact that it's a single-site approximation.
Yeah.
But the reason why I was wrong is that even though it's a single-site approximation, it works with the self-energy, and the self-energy enters in the Green's function at arbitrary distances. So you have some control over the Green's, some control over the large distance features of your theory. Mass, the criticality in particular, is detected via the pole in the Green's function.
Yeah, but in terms of correlation lengths, it still seems very strange.
it works too well. Sometimes you get lucky.
Well, it works well on one dimension, on 3+1 dimension, and not really on probably 1+1.
Exactly. So I agree with you. So the regime where it works well is weak interaction and high dimension. And there are many problems in four dimensions for which the interaction is not so strong that the result is so bad.
Excuse me, to calculate psi squared, you can still stay with 2 points?
One point.
That's a question of terminology.
Well, single particle Green function. You don't have to go to higher order.
No, because the quantity that you work with is gxx from this point x back to the same point x. A single site.
You can take a self-consistent rate normalization or Andrew's Lorentz treatment.
It is broader. Exactly, but the point is they are not exactly the same equations.
Yeah,
but
very similar.
Yeah, just happens
to
do a better job.
Yeah. So here was the first example. Now we go, we look at second result, which is the phase diagram. So remember my two dimensionless couplings are called lambda, the strength of the quartic coupling, and kappa, the hopping parameter, the strength of the ferromagnetic nearest neighbor interaction. So here is my phase boundary. Above, I have a broken symmetry. Below, my symmetry is realized. This is free theory, and over there is the easing model when lambda is infinity. So my phase boundary can be determined by Monte Carlo. This is, again, the green data. And then this exact answer can be compared with mean field, which the usual traditional mean field, which gives you this. And then DMFT is the red data. And EMFT, the single site further approximation, is the dotted blue line. So you can see that all three are very close to each other. And to see the accuracy in this region of parameters, here is an inset where lambda is small. And this is, again, the traditional mean field. And this is second order perturbation theory. And then there are these symbols here which look like they're blue, but in fact, if you zoom in further on these two, they're here, and here you can start to see that there are really three data points on top of each other, or not quite on top of each other here. Green is the Monte Carlo, then red is the MFT, then blue is the MFT. So you see that the approximation is not perfect, but it's pretty darn good.
So can I understand this EMFT from another way to do Hartree-Fock mean field decoupling? I can decouple phi to the order 4 to phi square average times phi square, and that reproduces.
I think it's probably very similar to so-called Bogolyubov-Popov approximation.
Right,
you have a single particle average, which would be psi.
Yeah. You have phi square average. You have two parameters.
Psi square is like a b dagger b dagger.
Right.
As a second one is.
Uh-huh.
And in this case, I believe when lambda is very large, then EMFT will be just MFT.
Well,
psi square becomes one.
I don't think so, because mean field, you see, gets the wrong answer this way. Green is the exact answer. But EMFT gets the wrong answer on the other side.
Because if lambda is very large and psi square is plus minus, psi square is always one.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't become like a variation parameter. It becomes like a Joe number.
No, still.
Can I make a comment on that?
Please.
You can view this as an approach in which there are two variational parameters.
Right.
One is the order parameter, as usual in theory. And the other one is the correlation length, essentially.
It's two correlation
lengths.
Sigma, you see this. This is k squared plus sigma of zero. Sigma of zero is psi minus two. So we are not the first to play with variational theories that have correlation length and order parameters, variational parameters. But if you look at, and Massa mentioned the Moriya and so on, if you look in the literature, there are many different such schemes. There is the so-called spherical approximation, there is the Moriya approximation. It just so happens that this is, but all these set of equations are different. Jim Langer also played with that millions of years ago. You know, there are all different approximations. It just so happens that those ones that are sort of remotely inspired by EMFT give very good answers.
French are lucky people.
Well, psi square becomes one, right? So then that's another correlation parameter becomes.
Yeah, but phi square is not really the variational parameter. The variational parameter is really the correlation.
So it's not phi square.
It's psi minus two. And vice square is not the variational boundary, it's the thing you try to adjust. Vice square is, until the self-consistency condition imposed on vice square.
Exactly.
Right. So in the limit you are talking about,
actually,
you impose vice square.
You're going to see these equations in Oscar's talk. It, maybe someday.
Is there any sense of index correction?
We try, but if you go beyond the quadratic approximation, then you can't obtain easily the non-interacting wave function. If you have a suggestion, of course. So, okay, DMFT works very well. Gives you information on what I call two-point function, the Green's function from x to y. It gives you masses. It since you have information as a function of the distance, you can reconstruct the Green's function in a finite box or in finite temperature. And then EMFT is even cheaper. And you bypass Monte Carlo, so in cases where you have technical problems like sine problem, this can be very beneficial. And Oscar will or will not describe applications dealing with those. Thank you.
Okay, so I propose to postpone more questions for Oscar.
Yeah.
And then we can stay later.
Yeah, thanks for the very thorough introduction. I hope the method is now more or less clear to everyone. So I would like to take some minutes to discuss applications and other models that we have looked at. So yeah, I will talk about two models. So first, the complex 5-4, which is just a very simple extension of this real 5-4 theory that we studied. But now the field is complex. And so there is a conserved charge in the system, which can be coupled to a chemical potential. And this will then introduce a sine problem, which prohibits standard Monte Carlo simulations. And then so we want to see how good this EMFT. Yeah, so I will talk only about EMFT from now on. So we wish to see how good this works for more interesting or more complicated models. And as Philippe said, there is no sine problem because you basically have a one-dimensional integral over your field or whatever dimension your field has. And we can access then arbitrary chemical potentials mu and temperatures T. So we can map out, for example, the phase diagram of this modeling in mu and T. And then I will talk about something called the Higgs-Yukawa model. With higher dimension operators. So this is a model, a poor man's version of the standard model where we take the Higgs field, the SU2 doublet, and all standard model fermions with chiral couplings to this Higgs field. And we introduce also higher dimension operators as a generic BSM-induced feature. So we study, for example, electroweak baryogenesis. So we study the finite temperature phase transition in the electroweak sector in this model. And so there are here also some Monte Carlo simulations that we compare with, so sort of to benchmark our model or approximation, but we can go beyond what these Monte Carlo simulations can do because they are sort of restricted in parameter space and obviously in lattice sizes and so on. Yeah, in this size. Right, so let me start with complex 5-4 with a chemical potential. So this is a relativistic Bose gas in 3+1 dimensions. And I guess the condensed matter people know this as effective theory for the Mott insulator at the tip of the Mott lobe. So, right, so this is basically the same as before, but we have this new coupling mu to the conserved charge, basically. And since J0 is imaginary, this introduces a, and this makes the Lagrangian and action complex. So you have this sign problem. Yeah. Right, so there is a global U1 symmetry, and we have spontaneous symmetry breaking to this Bose-condensed phase, basically when mu reaches the renormalized mass. But as probably people are aware, this can actually be solved. I mean, you can solve the sign problem by going to these so-called dual variables. So we have exact results to compare with. So this is more like a test. So there is no new results here, but it gives an it's an interesting test. Right, and yeah, EMFT works. I mean, you can easily write down this effective.
Yeah, what really do work.
Well, yeah, this is, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, you can write down this effective action. So I will not derive it here, but basically in a hand-wavy way, you can sort of guess the structure. So we take this local limit of DMFT. So okay, here I go back to calling this kernel delta, as Antoine did. So, yeah, so, okay, K and delta is the same, basically. So this is now a contact term because we take the omega equals zero term only. So you know you get a shift in the quadratic term. So this is like a mass shift, right? And this will also be a mass renormalization. This is probably the reason why it works so good, because it renormalizes your mass non-perturbatively to put you exactly on the phase transition. And then you have this external field. And the way these parameters enter here is, I mean, yeah. This has to be derived, but it's nothing really complicated. Yeah, so phi 1 and phi 2 here is the real and imaginary part of your field. And we use then this global U1 symmetry to put the expectation value on the real axis. So this makes this real. But in principle, of course, you can do this complex integral, so it doesn't really matter, but just for convenience.
Sorry. Yes. Yeah. I have the wrong accent again. Actually, I have the same question. I'm still puzzled as to why lambda is the same in the effective theorem.
Oh, because of what Antoine described, you take this local part of your action or Hamiltonian or whatever, and you keep this exact. This can be anything. I mean, you can have any.
Just because the interaction is more.
Exactly. It's completely, so you can treat any local potential here.
Right.
It's completely arbitrary. Right, so you have these self-consistency equations which Philippe and Antoine talked about. So here it's more explicit form. So yeah, you know the expectation value of phi must be phi. So this phi here is the expectation value of the field under this action. So yeah, this expectation value is then, of course, just phi evaluated under this. You integrate phi 1 and phi 2 from minus to plus infinity with this action. And then you have for the second moment. So here, the second moment, I mean, this is like the Green's function, of course, for the effective zero site or one site problem. But these delta guys enters here. So this is how they are coupled. So it's not like phi squared is enter. Phi squared, average of phi squared doesn't enter up here. It enters through delta. So this is how you connect the two, and you integrate over all momenta. So now it's completely Lorentz invariant. Although you can break this if you want to study finite temperature or so on. Yeah, so these are your three coupled self-consistency equations which you have to solve iteratively. But this is obviously very efficient, right?
It's a master.
Right, it's a mass renormalization more or less, yeah. And you can do some more with wave function renormalization also. But, as usual in any lattice calculation, you can set the scale by looking at taking some mass because you have now the correlator, so you have the mass and or expectation values. So this is the usual way of setting the scale, and we can go to finite temperature or finite volume, so we have full control over this, over the box through these momentum integrals, right? So some results. So here we show the charge density, which is basically the derivative of the log of C with respect to mu for two different values. So this eta is mu 0 squared plus 8. So this is basically the bare mass. So as you reduce eta, you go towards the continuum limit. So by reducing this, so you see this also on the scale here, right? So basically A is here 1/10 of the lattice spacing on the left figure. Yeah, and so the results are basically on top of, so for the larger lattice spacing, our results are basically on top of the Monte Carlo result.
Monte Carlo are the symbols, and EMFT are the lines.
Right.
The lines don't necessarily go through the symbols.
Yeah.
But it turns out they do on the
left.
Yeah.
So what is eta?
Yeah, so eta is more or less the square of the bare mass. Plus 2 times the dimension. Yeah, so this is a square mass of 1. But so the critical is something a little bit below this. You would have the critical eta defined as mu critical being 0, so where the lattice spacing is 0.
It fixes the mass of the boson in lattice units.
Yeah. Right, and then closer to the continuum limit, then obviously the Monte Carlo has some finite size problem, so it's kind of rounded. But still agrees very well, or EMFT still agrees very well with the result and gives you a sharp transition because we are in infinite volume by construction. Then we calculate the full T mu phase diagram. So again, the symbols are here Monte Carlo, and so the red one is for the larger lattice spacing, and for the blue one, the smaller lattice spacing, there are two symbols which corresponds to two different ways of determining this position of the phase transition by looking at the susceptibility of two different parameters, basically. And the lines are, again, EMFT, and they are basically, the arrows here are fairly large, but we are definitely close and within arrows of the Monte Carlo. So it seems that the model approximation works very well, and even when you're close to a second order phase transition. And yeah.
But this Monte Carlo data, you produce them, or those are from
This is from, I should mention that this is from Gattringer and Kloiber.
Okay.
So,
I wasn't aware that the error bars were so large.
Yeah, it depends also on the scale which you look, right? I mean, if you zoom in, they are large. So they didn't really aim at the precision study here, I guess. So you could certainly do better with Monte Carlo if you spend more time. But yeah. So clearly there is no problem, because the design problem doesn't pose any problems for EMFT, and gives very consistent result with Monte Carlo here. Yeah. So let me go on to the Higgs-Yukawa model. So as I said, this is kind of a performance version of the standard model. So we neglect all the gauge fields, but take the Higgs term interaction, which is, again, basically a 5 to the 4th, but now it's a 4-component field. And then we add this BSM term, I mean, just 5-6, which is then, of course, suppressed by 2 powers of some mass scale where you... Well, this could sort of be like if you have a new mediator particle, this would be its mass, more or less, with a coefficient of order 1 in a generic case. So the fermion and Higgs interaction is given by this Lagrangian. So you have the dynamic kinetic term and then chiral interactions between the two fields. And to ensure that we have chiral fermions also on the lattice, we implement this with the overlap operator. So then we want to test how well this works, because the fermions are sort of a new feature we didn't test before. So there are some Monte Carlo simulations performed by Carl Janssen and collaborators, which is although restricted to some degenerate case, for example, they have to take the top mass to be equal to the bottom mass, otherwise they will have a sign problem in the fermion determinant. But we can also do this, so why not? And yeah, as I said also, because of this scale separation of, so you have some large mass which enters through this phi 6, which is much larger than the expectation value. You have some, and you have also massless Gaussian bosons. The Monte Carlo simulations will have, I mean, due to the Gaussian bosons, they will have a power law finite size correction. So, yeah, it's very challenging computation. So you need to have very large lattices, which makes it very expensive, of course. Yeah, but we can work directly in the infinite volume. So this is a comparison. So here we call lambda 6 is the lattice spacing times this BSM mass to the negative square. And so here it's small and it's kind of perturbative. So what you see here is the pluses are the Monte Carlo data. The solid lines are our EMFT approximation. And this dashed line is something called constraint effective potential. So both the pluses and the dashed line is taken from this paper by Janssen. And this is kind of a perturbative effective model. So, yeah, so the y-axis is the expectation value lattice units. And this kappa is this mass parameter with the usual mass parameter in phi 4. So here for small lambda 6, everything works. I mean, basically everything works pretty well, so yeah, good. But it's also perturbative.
So Pascal, just to get an idea, how costly are the Monte Carlos here? How
think
CPU are we thinking about?
The project started 2 years ago.
So it's definitely in the order of months.
With the collaboration of half a dozen people.
Okay, so
we are
talking about the
month.
Planet science collaboration.
Yeah, this is cluster months. Yeah, I mean rack months probably. And this is EMFT is. This is maybe 5 minutes or something like that, or more or less. Yeah, this is really quick to calculate.
Where were the masses of the top and bottom
coming? They come in from. I should have said that. But in the Yukawa couplings, we fix this to the three-level mass. So yeah. So everything here, yeah, this is for bottom and top at 175 or so, yeah.
So the Monte Carlo method is very different from the one used for the scalar, the pure scalar problem.
Yeah, definitely.
The pure scalar problem, I think they don't have a sign problem.
No.
In this
No, there is no sign problem. Yeah. But here there is no sign problem.
Yeah. There is no sign problem.
No, there is no sign problem.
In the Monte
Carlo? No, because they have this degenerate top and bottom masses.
Okay. Yeah.
So this makes you have two direct determinants, but they are not. So you have the square.
Yeah, it's not
the
square.
But if we crank up this lambda 6 to 1, we see that, so EMFT still lies basically on top of the Monte Carlo results, whereas this perturbative approach doesn't really, work anymore. So, this is still kind of extraordinary that it works this well, I would say. It was surprising that it actually worked that well, so. Because it's a fairly simple approximation, really. It's not so sophisticated. But.
So
this is. This is not a physical example,
right?
But this is what they simulated, so we have to compare with something. In reality, you would take lambda 6 to be smaller than 1, obviously.
Course,
yeah, it cannot be.
It's not our choice.
Yeah.
They have to go to benchmark
5 minutes versus 2 minutes.
But this is the maximum value which you might consider. This is sort of the upper bound of what you might consider. For lambda 6.
What is the qualitative difference between
1 and 0.1?
Not really much, right? I mean, you still have. Yeah, and so I will show this later, but basically you have here second order transitions. And as you take this quartic coupling to be more and more negative, you at some point go into first order transition. And but this happens for both. Yeah.
So, what you showed us, Philip, in three dimensions, all of the phase solution was predicted wrongly, right?
Yeah.
So, what is exactly here? Can we. Is this 4 dimensional? I understand. Yeah.
And the transition is sometimes first order, so
it's depends on lambda 4. It gets the same lambda 4 where it goes from the third to the second order.
Yeah, so this can be seen here, right? I mean, here it's second order. This is sort of at the verge where it turns first order. And here it's probably have a jump. Yeah, I mean, definitely in the EMFT it stops here. And yeah, would argue, okay, maybe it's second order still, but here it's clearly first order, so it's at least it's very close. But this is the resolution that we have in that sense. So for the Monte Carlo data.
The EMFT, how do you distinguish first from second order? Just look at the whether it's continuous or not, is that it?
Yeah, basically yes. I mean
there is no finite size scale again.
No. So I just we look at how small can you make the order parameter.
Okay.
And yeah, it can be. There is some fuzzy region where it's very hard to tell because you run into numerical problems. But here it's very clear because you have a reentrance of the order parameter. So it goes like this, and I mean it goes back. So you can clearly say, okay, here it jumps, and then you can look at sort of free energy to determine where is, to distinguish really where is the phase boundary. But yeah, but it gives you. A fairly close approximation of where it jumps. So this is, so here, let me just quickly show the finite size effects. So here from EMFT, we just show that the correction to the Higgs mass goes like a power of the volume. And the power is exactly, this is a fit, so it's but very close to 3, which I guess you also would expect since the Goldson bosons are sort of in a finite box, they would go like something like 1 over L cubed. So this seems to work very well. So there are good reasons to expect that this finite temperature prescription also works very well. Yeah, and this is just schematics where you expect to be if you have a 32 lattice of size 32, you would be somewhere here, depending on the lattice spacing, of course. But yeah, you need fairly large lattices to see the asymptotic scaling. There is this business with the Higgs lower mass bound, but obviously if you introduce new operators, this changes completely, right? Then you can lower the Higgs mass. I mean, this question sort of loses its relevance in this case, but you can make the Higgs mass very small. So this is more or less the effective potential or the derivative. So you have fixed points here at 0. 0 is always a solution. And then here at 246. And the slope sort of gives you the Higgs mass. So, yeah, this is a stable fixed point for all these masses. So, you can take, even at large MBSM, you can have a small Higgs mass. Right, so this is the zero temperature phase diagram. Four-dimensional, yes.
Yeah, well, the behavior near zero is something you can't reach.
Well, yeah, so this is not exactly the effective potential.
Normal renormalization.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's what everybody thought.
So, this is a bit cheating because this is not the true effective potential. There are some corrections to this, but this is sort of, the flow of in your self-consistency equations. So in which direction does this external field want to go?
What's doing this stuff? What is doing this stuff? What is that scale?
Here?
Yeah.
Well, zero is a self-consistent solution, but as soon as you go away, you're driven away from zero. So
it's a maximum.
Yeah. So I still would say that the effective potential or the derivative is sort of proportional to this, but there are corrections. And there might be some terms which are not calculable when you have a negative mass, right? So as I said before, so here at lambda 6 and lambda 4 plane, you have this region of second order, and if you take lambda 4 to go more and more negative, you will cross to a first order transition. So this is this critical, tri-critical line. And you want to stay sort of close to this when you do your simulations for physical reasons. But I mean, obviously the model makes sense also for lambda 6 going to be anything, but in a strict sense, we want to be in sort of this region where we can make a physical interpretation of the parameters. So this is one example where, I forgot to put this, but lambda 6 here is 1/4. So A times MBSM is 2. So you still have a separation of scale. Maybe it's not really big enough, but you still have the lattice space. So you have a mass or scale hierarchy of the expectation value, the lattice spacing, and this BSM mass. So this is the phase diagram in the kappa lambda plane. So here, lambda becomes more negative in this direction. So this is the quartic coupling. So here you have a broken phase, and here you have the symmetric phase. So here it's a second order transition if you drive the transition by kappa. And at some point it turns first order at this star, and then it's first order all the way here. So this line here is for zero temperature. And then as you increase the temperature by decreasing nt from infinity to something finite, this star, this tricritical point, moves along this trajectory. And this means that this area, which is swept out by the first order curve, is the region where you expect to have a first order transition at finite t. So this is what we are interested in ultimately, for phenomenological reasons, where you have a, where you can have electric baryogenesis or so on.
In finite temperature field theory, there's this T to the 3/2 term that's responsible for this first order behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That must be.
This enters, I think, from the momentum integral. Basically in the same way as it does, I mean, in the usual way, right? And now I show if we transform the variables to physical coordinates, like the Higgs mass MH and this BSM mass, and look at the strength of the transition. So in all this second order region, so we quantify the strength of the transition as phi c over tc, where phi c is the expectation value at the jump. So obviously for a second order transition, it's zero because there is no jump. So in all this region, it's zero. And at this solid line, it's also zero, but at this tri-critical value. And then as you go in this direction and decrease the BSM mass, you turn your transition from second order to first order, and you increase the strength, obviously. I mean, it becomes stronger and stronger. So here we plot 0, 1/2, and 1. And it doesn't really depend much on, there is some dependence, of course, but you can go to a fairly strong transition. So 1 is sort of the nominal value where you would expect to have a strong enough transition for electroweak baryogenesis. And this is still in the same ballpark as 0. And just for reference, I've marked here 125 and 1500 GeV. If you say your Higgs mass is 125, obviously you have corrections now to gauge fields in the real world, Anyway, and this would give a BSM mass of like 1.5 TeV or so. So this in this region, more like 1.3. Thanks. 1.3. So it's, but you have gauge fields in. I mean, so you can push this up, I guess. But so it's it's still a bit interesting, I think. It's not 400 GeV, so.
So this NBSM was defined as coefficient was 1 over NBSM.
Right, so yeah.
Without the small number.
Exactly. Yeah, so yeah, by making the coupling small, you can also push it, well, you know, that's true. Yeah, and this color coding is just TC, so it's about, you know, order of 100 to 200 TV, GV. Yeah, and this is in GV. Right, so yeah, so conclusions. EMFT works very, very well, I would say. Also, I mean, for both these models, and it's very cheap, and so it's a nice thing to do exploratory studies, what is feasible and so on, and then if you want to have precision studies, I mean, obviously you don't get all the information, but you know if it's worth doing a large scale computation or not, so this could be very interesting. And yeah, you can treat sign problems and chiral fermions without much problem. And yeah, this is what I said before, that there is some hints here of interesting range of masses where you can have electroid baryogenesis. Yeah. And to improve upon all this, I mean, I think, yeah, there are many. Obviously, you can take like high-order couplings and so on, but this is quite challenging. But so the obvious first improvement to make is to go away from one-site model to a small cluster, which is called cluster GMFT in the condensed matter region, but you could do this to EMFT as well. So, and this, when you have a sort of a, if you have a cube of eight sites, I guess, or 16, you could have plaquettes on this cube, and maybe somehow you could treat your, extend this to gauge fields, but you know, we have not really been able to do this yet.
Questions to anybody?
Do you expect any different physics when the top and bottom masses are different?
Sorry, I should really have said that. So in our in all these calculations, we work with all 9 standard model fermions at their physical masses.
And does that change quantitatively?
No, not quantitatively. No, only qualitatively. Yeah.
You work with all 9.
Yeah. Well, the tree-level masses. So the tree-level masses. So we set all the Yukawa couplings to the tree-level value. But obviously, the top really dominates. The bottom makes a difference. The other ones are, yeah. But it doesn't make a difference in the computation, really, so we can just put them all in.
So it's maybe just to better understand how this EMFT really works. So in the very first example, which is very similar to the interacting both gas, people starting condensed matter.
Yeah.
So there are different type of approximations, which is called Hartree fork, Canary restricted Hartree fork. So introducing different type of variational parameters, or you know, you force your Green function to fulfill the first moment. And in various cases, you get very good results. Mm-hmm. Concerning the static correlation functions. Mm-hmm. But in some cases, those approximations break the internal symmetry of the problem. So instead of getting the Goldstone mode, you get some spurious gap for the Goldstone mode.
Okay.
I was wondering if here, in the first example, you know, so if you calculate the spectrum of excitation, if you know, you have a real true Goldstone mode by because of breaking
U1
gauge symmetry?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So actually, at least, so this is the reason for this set H. So if you have 1 here and calculate the mass matrix, there is 1 eigenvalue, which is supposed to be the Goldstone mode, which is very small, but not exactly 0. I mean, it doesn't come out as exactly 0. So it's much, much smaller than the Higgs mass, or yeah. But you can introduce now this extra parameter to force it to be exactly 0. So that is also what we do in all the calculations later. So yeah, so in the results, we constrain the mass matrix to have a 0 eigenvalue, but it doesn't come out automatically by itself.
But the H has a physical meaning, which is the wave function normalization.
Yeah, right.
So it's there for good reasons.
Yeah.
Isn't it just a threat and effect on the order of the lattice spacing or something?
Sorry?
Isn't it on the order of the lattice spacing where you get this difference between zero and whatever it is calculated?
Which one?
You said the small eigenvalue.
Yeah. If it, yeah, you mean if it's proportional to the.
By the scale of the lattice spacing, which is going to zero.
Yeah, perhaps.
You have phase diagram with two different lattice spacing, so maybe you can appreciate the next one. Yeah. So red and blue are estimates of the phase diagram with two different lattice spacings, differing by a factor 10 or so. So that gives you an idea of the discretization error.
Yeah, how does it go?
Well, so it's normalized, so it's always one here. Yeah. But you see that it bends away, I guess. Yeah.
Which one's the smaller?
The blue one.
Oscar, EMFT is a, EMFT is a continuum calculation, right?
No. It's, well, it could be, I guess, but you have to regularize your theory somehow.
Oh, okay.
And we do it for the lattice. Yeah. But it's an infinite, it can be an infinite lattice, for example. Okay. We regularize it on the lattice.
So I'm coming back. Australians think I have a problem with lambda.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to think how I should, if I think about this as this is a fancy way of truncating the Tower of Bison-Shapiro equation. You're truncating it at the order where you say the self-energy is a constant in this case. And if I kind of think of that tower of equations, at some point I have dynamics in the four-point coupling, right? And I would get a renormalized four-point function. Can I think about that I could extend this by keeping more of the Schwing-Dyson equations?
Well, I think, yeah, in principle, yes, you can extend it. But if you have then the problem, at least that we couldn't solve, is how to constrain these high-order interaction terms. But it certainly, we tried some different things, but it worked worse. So, but it's the usual case, like, you know, if you do a incomplete improvement, it's usually not an improvement, right?
So by that you mean that if you add 2 phi squared, you also have 5 quant and so on.
Yeah.
And you try to use, so with variation parameters in front of it.
Yeah.
And you try to use constraint on average value, yeah.
Something like, yeah.
To higher order moment.
Exactly.
So you try things like that.
Yeah, I think we've tried with the cubic term. So have something here. I think probably even in the DMFT.
So the cubic breaks some symmetries now.
Yeah, but this also breaks symmetries. Yeah, right. Yeah. So to have a phi cube here.
What about higher even terms?
Like, yeah, to renormalize lambda, yeah. Basically. Yeah. Yeah, you could, I guess, maybe.
And impose conditions on phi to the form.
Yeah, but it's hard to know what these conditions should be. But, I mean, you can try different things, of course, and maybe. Yeah.
So the approximation works so well as it is that it needs a benchmark where you can control how much it fails, and where you can induce a big failure and fix that, but we haven't found that.
I didn't completely understand how the CH is fixed.
Well, so let me go to this. Yeah, so basically.
Oh, that's the condition of zero mass, okay.
Exactly, yeah.
I impose
a zero mass. Yeah.
That's like we call it Hohenberg pi ceiling in condensed Bose gas. So the self energy has to pull free static part of the self energy has to fulfill some constraint with respect to the chemical potential, and Zeta guarantees that the low energy spectrum is in the house.
Can I just ask a question about the wave functionalization which you had? So it's determined self-consistently, I guess?
Yes.
You also mentioned that that's the end, you fix it in such a way that the Goldstone bosons part, this small part is cancelled, so why is that?
Yeah, so this is the this is the only condition on this wave function renormalization. So in the in the original equations, it's one, because you have no real way to constrain it. But then we introduce it by hand and say that, well, the Goldstone bosons in infinite volume should be zero. So
you fix it this way, that's the way.
Yeah, this is way it fixes.
What are the numbers which you
get? It's very close to one. Oh. It varies per mil level or so. Depending a bit on you, but it usually goes to one at the phase transition because it must be one in the symmetric phase. Yeah. But it's a very small correction, so numerically in the results it doesn't really make big difference, because the Goldstone mass is really very small already, but it gives you some better convergence of your numerical equations. So that's the main advantage of including this parameter.
Pascal, this criterion about the Goldstone boson, how it works in the order phase.
Yes.
In the order phase, you just see it for a while.
Yeah, but they are not massless in the.
No, I understand.
Yeah, but yeah, then the CH is one. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Can you use it in 3D?
Yes.
Do you get the KDI as
well? No. Well, not to a very good accuracy. It gives the wrong first order transition. For example, in 5.4 in 3D, where you know that there is a second order transition, we actually see a first order transition. So it doesn't really work very well. Yeah. But the dimension is completely arbitrary. We can do, I mean, it also doesn't influence the numerics, so we can do 1,000 dimensions, whatever.
Probably you get critical exponents of the spherical model, right?
Yeah.
Because the equations are similar structure.
Yeah.
Another question, I mean, if you take this model serious, you know, as a model in itself, you know how to renormalize it. I have a good reason for asking this question. But it's not the main point.
Didn't really think about that.
Okay, so we thank the three speakers for